Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody. It's Bilge Pumps episode 79. And so we're well past pensionable age. We're going on for 80.
And almost as old as what? New Jersey?
Almost as old as I feel sometimes reading some of these headlines.
Almost as old as Haida. Mm. It's her 80th birthday this year. HMCS Haida. Yeah.
Okay. So that's a bit older. So just we'll worry when we start reaching Constitution and victory.
Yes. Oldest commission podcast. But as you can probably tell from the voices, we are joined by the regular crew, so Jamie from Armour Carriers, Dr. Alexander Clark, and of course myself, a Drakinophil of all the Drakinophils. So what have we got on the table today?
We've got a lot of fun stuff.
Mm.
We've got Ukraine. What
do ships have got to do with Ukraine?
Yes.
What can you do if you do about Ukraine with a navy?
Mm-hmm. We got hypersonics
and microwaves. Yeah,
maybe.
Jiffy Pop. In which case, so I get to start using Jiffy Pop as an example.
Mm-hmm. And what else have we got?
Gatekeeping in history, possibly.
Possibly. That should be
depending
fine.
Depending on what mine and Drac's stress levels are like. Jamie laughs more about it. Me and Drac find it slightly more annoying.
So, in other words, a wide range of topics that's guaranteed to annoy everybody from the less progressive academics all the way through to the people with the buttons on the Russian label nuclear missiles. So, you know, we're not making too many enemies today.
Oh, we don't mean to make enemies. They just happen to happen around us.
I like them.
a steady supply of enemies. Yeah. At least the Slavs are moving into the Mediterranean. They're no longer within zircon range of London.
That's true.
And that's actually quite good for the Slavs being in the Mediterranean, because let's be honest, it's a lot calmer waters. Mm. So their hulls will not be quite as worn out. Because I've been worrying about them going through the North Atlantic, etc. I know they were well-built ships, but they were built ships a long, long time ago, and they've had a lot of modifications.
Personally, I think we should be sending the Irish fishing fleet in hot pursuit.
Why the Irish fishing fleet?
No, I mean, they managed to see the Russians off before. I mean, so far, we're talking about in
terms more like the Icelandic fishing fleet, but okay.
No. The Irish fishing fleet, they're the ones who protested about the weapons tests inside the Irish economic exclusion zone and won.
Yeah. So we're currently sitting at local-based fishing fleets off Britain and Irish waters 2, Russian Navy 0.
Okay, let's see if this ratio continues.
Okay, so not where's the Royal Navy, where's the nearest fishing fleet?
Yep. Where's the Irish fishing fleet in particular?
I don't know. There's just so much going on. If we start off, shall we start off with the hypersonics? Because that's the engineering one, and that's the cool one. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go on to Ukraine, because hypersonics feed into that. And then we'll probably feed into the gatekeeping in history. If we have time and we feel we haven't ranted at people enough.
Ukraine or hypersonics first?
Hypersonics?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, hypersonic missiles then. Obviously, the latest and greatest, supposedly, in anti-shipping technology, albeit that you do
nothing really all that new about them, other than the fact that they are becoming more popular and probably more reliable and better guided.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, and let's face it, any ballistic weapon is essentially any ballistic missile is essentially hypersonic.
Yeah, they just tend to be point at target before you launch. I think the main innovation now is making them into tracking weapons, isn't it?
Yes, it's the terminal guidance. Yeah.
Hmm.
And that's not proving all that easy, at least not for those of us in the Western Hemisphere. We seem to have this problem of the things shaking themselves to pieces. And I think that's actually what they're trying to achieve here.
Yeah.
They decided that, well, if you can't beat it, join it. So therefore, if lumps and bumps in the atmosphere keep destroying your hypersonics, well, maybe they can destroy your opponent's hypersonics.
Yeah. I mean, this latest article that's come out is looking at a number of different options. I mean, I love the, to be honest, I love the way that they've, one of the suggestions is an incredibly high-tech way of doing something that we've been talking about for quite a while. Using planes to dispense unwelcome metallic particles in the direction of a low-altitude hypersonic missile.
Chaff!
Yeah, it's... crop dusting for hypersonics? Yeah. As opposed
to... It doesn't have to be chaff, does it? It could just be... basically, if...
Flying metallic dust?
Fine metallic dust, or, you know, that'd do.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, a screen of magnesium dust, if a hypersonic flies through a screen of magnesium dust, you're sure as anything know where it is when the minor sun emerges on the horizon. But I mean, I do love the way they're just, yes, I know what we will do. We will load up an aircraft, a very localized, you know, point
slow
incident. Yeah. And we will have this thing go out and we'll drop a screen of metallic objects in front of the missile for it to hit so that it can go careening into the sea. And I'm sitting there going, yes, you could do that. Or you could do what we've been telling you to do for a very long time and put a dual 40 millimeter or a 57 millimeter CIWS on the side. And then you can shoot lots of little unwelcome metallic particles in a big screen for a very prolonged period of time. You don't have to worry about the whole faff of launching an aircraft and getting into position.
They keep wanting to reinvent the wheel. They're trying to invent newer, sexier flak so they can claim it's not flak.
Yeah. To be fair, flak radius, you know, is it far enough to actually have an effect against a hypersonic weapon?
Yeah,
so, you know, your 40 millimeter is not going to throw that lump of throw that slug containing your fine magnesium dust far enough. The 57 millimeter, probably not even that. So it'd be at least your 5-inch, wouldn't it?
No, maybe. 76.
Well, it depends on the type of projectile and everything. But the thing is, as you pointed out earlier, Jamie, it's like compared to a hypersonic, a plane might as well be stuck in the mud.
Yes.
I mean, even if you've got one on combat air patrol, if something's coming in at Mach 5, even if you, like, I mean, combat air patrols are usually not flown at sea level. They're usually flown quite a way up in the sky.
Then again, you know, where is the hypersonic coming from? High or low? You don't know.
Well, again, this particular proposal, it strikes me as kind of, you know, the modern unrotated projectile with their idea of the aerial minefield. They've kind of forgotten that air is a 3D environment. You know, if you put a minefield, which effectively is what this is, just a stat.
I've got this one. Lovely 2D map which shows me everything. So why are you talking about a 3D? It's all lovely 2D map.
As they said in Star Trek Wrath of Khan, two-dimensional thinking, Captain. I mean, let's face it. If you want to scale everything down in speed, bearing in mind in the interwar period, the US Navy had this idea of using aircraft to fly in front of their strike aircraft and drop a smoke screen behind which the torpedo bombers could attack so they wouldn't be shot at with flak. And they abandoned that for numerous reasons, including, you know, the fact that the aircraft, you know, if you've got an aircraft that's already well ahead enough that it can drop a smoke screen, a meaningful smoke screen to shield your torpedo aircraft, well, that aircraft should probably be doing the attacking because it's already there. And again, being a 3D environment, it's like, yes, you've dropped a smoke screen. Wouldn't it be such a tragedy if, you know, a ship was there instead of right here, or there was an aircraft from one of the enemy aircraft carriers?
And the other problem, of course, is that your torpedo bombers can't see the ship they're targeting.
Yes, I mean, that's also not exactly helpful. You know, But
the Royal Navy then go for the complete opposite thing by attacking at night and using shit aircraft dropping flares behind the enemy.
When no one can see anything. then we are all equal. And, apart from anything else, you know, if you're on a combat air patrol, if you just happen to be by happenstance in the opposite quarter of your circle to where the hypersonic's coming in, it's kind of like, okay, that hypersonic is traveling. Let's say you're cruising, probably traveling 10 times, if not faster than you are. so you can only cover 1/10 of the distance. You might be able to go like full afterburner, maybe, and then it reduced to only faster than you.
If you're in the, if you're in an F-35, you're going to only do that for 30 seconds before your plane falls apart.
But you know,
no, not 30 seconds, 32.
If the thing is, if your aircraft is anything but already there, directly between the missile at the point it appears and the ship, you're not going to get there in time anyway. And the faster you move in, the slower you are to turn. And then you've got to make sure you're at the right height, which means someone's got to calculate the incoming ballistic arc. It would be like saying, you know, we're going to defend ourselves against enemy artillery fire by one guy with a Lee Enfield, and he's going to just try and shoot the shells out of the sky.
There was a story written a few years ago. It was a science fiction one, but it was published on a naval history site. I think it was published on the SimSec. I'm not sure. Anyway, it had the Royal Navy aircraft carriers were operating F-18s, which would be lovely, but no, they're not that type of carrier. And B, it had this guy who survived the war against China, but his first wife hadn't, because she'd been in a plane of F-18 flying tanker ops when the AI on the carrier had taken control of her aircraft and flown it into the missiles to protect against the missiles coming on the carrier. There are two problems with that. One, they're not going to be fast enough to actually get into in front of the missiles. And two, I'm not sure an F-18 would be guaranteed to hit the missiles to take it out. It was a lovely, very mournful story to read, but it's like a lot of these things, it's not really viable. And it's like when we talk about the 76mm or the 57mm or the 40mm, we don't mean a single mount with a pair of them would be enough. We talk about a ship having multiple mounts. This is the problem. Once you start, you have to explain that flak is a scalable thing and you need a lot of it to work. And it's also a very dumb and very simple approach, but it does work until you have your something points better.
Failure. Fewer points of failure.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Jamie is always quite right. He brings up the point about range, etc. I think 57mm or 40mm, if you've got enough of them, will provide you with enough range. But you can go for the Italian 76mm, which has some very interesting, very programmable options, including, I was once told, I'm not quite sure if I went through the shell, a shell which, when it was blown up at the range, would turn into a whole host of molten copper balls going out, which would cover an area about 1,000 feet, a radius of about 1,000 feet, which is a very small area when you're talking about a three-dimensional defense of a carrier. But I also have this feeling that a molten copper ball hitting any kind of, coming in any near contact with a hypersonic missile would cause quite a lot of damage, because molten copper can go through most armor on tanks.
Well, at that point, to be honest, it's just kinetic energy. It could be molten aluminium. It could be tissue paper.
Might as well make it ferrous irons, because at least that way you can feed the plankton.
Yeah. If you hit it,
you're being helpful to the environment, Jamie. You have cracked onto it. Well, I mean, we can get them to go for flak if we tell them it was also green and environmentally friendly.
There was a photo I saw recently of a hypersonic test vehicle that flew through a rainstorm.
Yes,
and the thing looked like it had been hit by a cheese grater just because of the water droplets had taken big chunks out of it. So hitting anything at those kind of speeds is bad news.
So the point of the point of this discussion is when something's going 7 to 10, I think minimum speed to be hypersonic is 5 times the speed of sound. Basically, the skin of your aircraft is replaced by a plasma film around the outside of your aircraft, or your flight body, or whatever you want to call it, and that is, incredibly hot, and B, incredibly fragile. So anything that disrupts that flow of that plasma film around your airframe will destroy your airframe because it's way beyond the blowtorch. And this is why so many US and Australian tests of hypersonic glide bodies have failed. because they hit turbulence in the atmosphere, and it gets to a point where their control surfaces can't maintain the stability of the flying body enough for it to prevent the plasma from making contact with the actual body itself. Now, it looks as though one of the ideas here is to say, well, okay, why don't we just embrace our enemy and make the atmosphere in front of an oncoming hypersonic weapon much more turbulent? And the idea is to pump microwaves into down a channel, I suppose, ripping through the air and turning it into a maelstrom, which your nice little 7 times, 10 times the speed of sound weapon bumps into. And at that speed, it's probably like hitting a brick wall.
I question this on the basis that, well, it's not a perfect analogy, but think about your standard kitchen microwave oven. That doesn't release massive clouds of superheated air after you've been cooking for several minutes. It's frequency tuned to the water particles in your food, which does make heating, drier foods a bit more difficult. But the point is, air is actually terrible for stopping microwave radiation. I mean, that's why it's used in a whole bunch of communications frequencies. That's why we use microwave radar, still do to a certain extent. Now, you can pump an awful lot of microwave energy through the air without a tremendous amount happening to the air. It works quite well on electronics, works quite well on water. The only problem is if you microwave the electronics out of existence on an incoming hypersonic warhead, it's now an inert hypersonic warhead. So if it was aimed in the correct direction, you're still dead.
Effect does it have on the plasma?
It's about creating unexpected, non-standard, non-AI predictable turbulence.
My issue would be, if you've got an energy projector that can pump enough microwave energy downrange to excite the air enough to create that kind of turbulence, you've got a directed energy projector that you could use much more efficiently in something just like a socking rate laser to blow the thing clean out of the sky in the first place.
I guess the laser does the same thing essentially in many ways. It disrupts that plasma flow around the airframe. It's introducing a non-conformal piece of heat to the equation,
it's just a slightly more direct and, to my mind, slightly more plausible way of doing it, because bearing in mind, obviously, you can't predict exactly where this vehicle is going, so you're going to have to be superheating a column of air. And if you can inefficiently use microwaves to superheat a column of air to a point where it's actually going to make any difference to a hypersonic vehicle, you could probably have covered your ship in 10 high-intensity laser cannons for the same energy for a better effect. Now, what I could see potentially as a combination of ideas would be, because obviously you want heat, given that the sensors and the guidance systems on these things are using all sorts of imaging, but heat is an issue. And if we want heat turbulence as well to try and throw everything off course, then perhaps a better idea would be to have your flak shells, as we discussed, have them fire out or along with the standard shrapnel warheads, you have some kind of fine particulate that is especially susceptible to microwave radiation. You fire that out in a screen ahead of the missile and it kind of just gradually filters down. So you've got a not quite so time sensitive projection. And then when the hypersonic's about to fly through it or just before, then you use your microwave projector to superheat. You direct it at the same area, but now you're superheating these particulates, which are much, much more susceptible to the radiation you're pumping out than the general air is. So suddenly you have whatever is magnesium, iron, whatever you dial your microwave frequency and choose your material appropriately, all of a sudden being superheated, they're all going to suddenly flare up as they vaporize, at which point you have a massive thermal screen, which the sensors on the missile are very unlikely to be able to see through, in at which the thermal screen in and of itself is probably going to have some interesting interactions with the plasma field, and you're going to create a hell of a lot more thermal turbulence to throw off any hypersonic than you would.
It's a very simple catalyst to get far more bang for your buck. I guess you know, the whole heating up
all it requires is a nice double 57 millimeter and about three of them.
But again, heating up the air is a much more complicated and energy intensive proposition than simply frying the electronics, the antennae, the gyroscopic equivalents on the thing. So I suppose that means that you know, whatever the case, if you're going to be building a hypersonic weapon and you're up against either increased turbulence or loss of your onboard electronics, you're going to have to harden it against it, aren't you?
Yes.
The simple
and that's
prospect,
going to be expensive and difficult.
So you get it, suddenly these things become bigger and heavier. And more expensive. So therefore, you don't quite have the swarms of hundreds of these things coming at your carrier. You might have dozens, which then I suppose you can fall back onto. That would make the your direct effect weapons somewhat more of a viable option.
You can then launch three or four SAMs to engage them. Because let's be honest, that's what you will end up doing. If it's coming in at that speed, it won't be a case of, I'm launching one per target, and then I'm going to see what happens. No, you're going to be going, fire one, fire two, fire three, fire four, target two, fire five, fire six, fire seven, fire nine.
It also comes down to time of engagement, which is something we've discussed previously with even something as mundane as supersonics. You know, if you from time of detection to time of impact, you have a fixed amount of time. For subsonic missiles, that time of engagement is practically however many missile you have in your magazine because of the closing speed. For supersonics, it starts to become like muskets or something. It starts to become a mathematical equation of, if you detect it at X range, you have Y seconds. If you can fire missiles at, you know, certain amount per second, that's how many you can launch before they hit, in anything else in your magazine depth doesn't matter for that engagement. It will matter tomorrow when they come back again. But with hypersonics, unless you've detected them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles out, and even then you're not going to have too much time, you're going to have an engagement period of handfuls of seconds at best. So if someone does launch dozens and dozens of them at you, then you're basically stuffed because you can't intercept them all in time. You physically can't fire off your munitions in time unless you have some kind of just physical barrier like a flak screen and it works properly. Whereas if you can, by the measures we've just discussed, if you can reduce the number of missiles that are being fired at you, then that means you have fewer targets to engage. And then perhaps if you have a fleet of 4, 6, 8 escorts all firing away merrily, maybe you can put enough missiles in the air to down the ones that make it through, because there might only be half a dozen that make it through rather than 6 dozen.
Yeah, well, this is really going to make matter. Space-based radar. And it's going to make that both for targeting and for defense against them.
Mind you, to be fair, given we're talking about hypersonics, I'd be less worried about radar. I'd just be using space-based infrared, because you ain't hiding a Mach 5 plus missile coming in. It's going to show up on every thermal sensor across the hemisphere if you're talking about a space-based platform.
But also, though, I suspect, you know, for me, the thing that, and by no means am I even an engineer, yet alone an expert in hypersonics, but how the hell do you get a hypersonic vehicle to sense what's in front of it through that plasma wall? You know, surely it would have to be getting telemetry from behind, guiding it towards its
It's an engineering challenge, but it can be done, because it basically depends on what part of the electromagnetic spectrum you're looking at. So it's kind of like, you know, when you see all these pictures of space, like the Crab Nebula or the
the pillars of creation or whatever, and they look really pretty, but then you see like six different photos that are in six different color schemes, and some of it is composited, but a lot of the time it's like, well, this is what it looks like through an X-ray telescope, this is what it looks like through a radio telescope, this is what it looks like through infrared. Different things show up at different wavelengths, and the same thing with the plasma. It's very, very hot, so yeah, having an infrared sensor stuck on the front of your missile is just going to just show white screen the entire time. But there will be other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, possibly right, some elements of the radar spectrum or whatever, where the interference from the plasma will be minimal to non-existent. It's just a question of whether or not you can then get a return on that frequency that is useful for targeting.
Yeah, speaking of that, there is someone going around trying to sell people on an ultraviolet hypersonic sensor. I'm not sure that will ever work. It sounds to me like someone's trying. It sounds to me snake oil salesman.
It depends.
I've heard about it at a couple of conferences now, and I've gone each time, ultraviolet?
What, to sense really? The hypersonics or to mount on the hypersonics?
Might mount on the hypersonics.
I mean, plasma throws off a hell of a lot of light, and UV is just a fraction outside the visible light spectrum. So,
yes.
But, you know, I've not looked into exactly what frequencies plasma emits at. So it's possible. There's a lot of funky things you can see when if you put UV transition lenses over your glasses. I think it's going to depend on what exactly you're looking at in terms of the plasmas, because the plasma is obviously going to depend partly on what speed you're going, therefore what temperature you're reaching, and also what elements you're flying through. So, I mean, normally that's going to be air, so that's relatively predictable. But you know, if it flies through a rain squall, apart from the damage, that's going to alter the balance of chemicals. And to be fair, although I'm not entirely sure about the delivery mechanism, but in theory, you could temporarily blind a sensor, because if it's got a relatively limited frequency band, then I don't think it'd be a particularly practical measure. But in theory, if you could deploy, if you're going to deploy clouds of something, whether it be flak or metallic particles or whatever, if you could deploy a cloud of whatever it is that when it flashes into plasma happens to emit on the frequency that the sensor is operating on, you could blind it. The main problem with that would be, given the speed of the hypersonic, you'd be blinding it for a fraction of a second while it punches through the cloud, which is why it's probably not going to work. But as a more defensive measure, if you can excite that cloud to emit, you could create a defensive cloud in front of yourself.
So, I mean, yeah, just get... You know,
basically a flashbang. Okay,
so microwaves would be... A microwave weapon would require a lot less energy, and therefore I suspect a lot less complexity to a laser.
If it was exciting some kind of frequency-attuned particulate matter, if you're using it against... air,
if you're trying to, so air is not viable.
No,
basically.
If you're using it in combination with a flak system,
if you're using it to fry the oncoming weapon's electronics and or excite, then you can then you can get an added bonus of combining it with your flak wall.
Yeah.
The
I think the main thing would be, as I said before, using it to fry the onboard electronics with a microwave weapon is probably the simplest and easiest application of microwave technology to the situation. The only problem then being you basically have an inert hypersonic impactor coming your way, which you're
sort
then
of hope that it would unsettle it, but even then I suppose it would still tumble into you as a, you know, as
yeah,
a
I mean,
fly and clean the engine.
You're basically just relying on it not being aimed particularly well at the time of that all its system short out, which might work. It might not. And I mean, that's the kind of thing where the shape of the glide vehicle might come into play. If people then think, oh, well, okay, if we're going to use that, then if they're going to use that, maybe we need to design our glide vehicle to be aerodynamically stable so that when it goes inert, it just stays on course. But
or have an analog system that maintains its stability.
Yeah, I don't know if you can develop an analog system that works in a plasma environment, but it'd be fun to try. but it's
keeps coming back, doesn't it? It keeps coming back to having something to interfere with its, 5,000 degree, 4,000 degree, whatever it is, leading edge. Yeah. So if you can get that piece of metal, piece of copper, piece of magnesium, it needs only to be the smallest grain of a powder, and then all of a sudden you've burnt off the entire wing, burnt a hole in the center.
The hilarious thing, not that this is an argument to bring back battleships, but the hilarious thing is that one of the most primitive ways a battleship defended itself against torpedo bombers, in theory, if the hypersonic missiles coming in at sea skimming level, would actually be a lot more viable these days, firing the big guns directly into the path.
So you have the splash, yeah.
Yeah, because I can guarantee you, if something traveling at Mach 6 runs into a 100-foot-wide column of uplifting water, there's nothing good coming out the other side. Well,
strangely enough, that could also be an argument to bring back the swordfish, because I'm just doing a video at the moment about the swordfish attacks on Bismarck, and a swordfish survived one of those hits. Flew through a column of a 15-inch shell, and all the fabric got ripped off the bottom of the swordfish, but it managed to get back to victorious. So, yes, go swordfish.
Yeah,
it should really be the unsinkable swordfish at that point.
Well, let's put it this way: I think the last thing you'll call a swordfish traveling at 90 knots is hypersonic.
Yeah.
Mind you, can you imagine some kind of analog, maybe vacuum tube? Opera, if someone invents some kind of like the raspberry not pie, or the strawberry tart operating system, which is basically a raspberry pie except made out of vacuum tubes, and you stick it in a swordfish. Once everyone's abandoned missiles in favor of microwave defenses, the swordfish is now the invincible strike platform, because you can microwave it all day and nothing's going to happen. It's like, I'm made of canvas, wire, and a few bits of iron. There'll be some fancy electronic sparks, but that doesn't matter to my vacuum tube technology.
This is the point, isn't it? Everything goes round and round in circles.
Yeah. Look, I keep every time I'm looking at these sort of things, and I'm looking at the hypersonics, and I'm looking at the options of them, there are so many technological challenges, and I do consider them very interesting. But there is more and more of me sitting there going, right then, they are going to be the headline act we're going to be having to deal with. But actually, the big threat is going to be what's below them down the threat scale in terms of numbers. It's going to be the cheapest chips, C-803 cruise missiles, all those systems. The things that they can deploy in not the tens, not the dozens, not the hundreds, but the thousands.
The things that aren't the headline acts.
Yes. The cheap and cheerfuls.
Well, effectively,
the not harpoons.
I mean, effectively,
the Exocet clones.
Yeah, if you want to, wind the timeline back to the period I do reenactment in, you're effectively talking about combined arms, except for missiles, because if you send in your hypersonics, your few expensive large hypersonics, it's effectively like an army that is just a few hundred knights. It's like, yes, incredibly effective right up until people just figure out the one, like, whatever complex system you need to counter them, there's few enough of them that it justifies investing in it all. And
you mean the pike?
Pikes, longbows are the best.
How many times did a coordinated cavalry charge actually happen in history? As opposed to how many times they wanted it to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. It's like even a coordinated cavalry charge on its own against a well-prepared army that has multiple different types of weapons users usually doesn't succeed. The cavalry charges either work if the enemy is largely a kind of a monolithic entity in terms of its weapons loadout, or they're broken or on the run, the latter of which doesn't really apply too much to this particular scenario. But where cavalry charges do tend to work very well is when the enemy has been softened up. So infantry, projectile, weapons, that kind of thing. You soften and break up your enemy, then you hit them with the big expensive stuff to cause maximum damage. And similarly here, I think that there's, instead of everyone focusing on one thing or the other, there probably is a certain degree of combined arms to be thought of, where, as you say, it's like cheap, cheerful, subsonic, but can still hurt you. You could potentially send hundreds of them in for minimal cost.
I imagine the microwave would be able to fry them just as effectively, if not more effectively, because they've got more time
But it's target saturation. Because if you send in hundreds upon hundreds of targets, or even if it's dozens upon dozens, any one of which could cause significant damage when it gets to you, you have to knock engage. All of them. It's the whole thing of you have to be lucky every time. They only have to be lucky once. You start engaging those, and then it turns out that you're 5 seconds into that engagement, and then coming up swiftly behind them are a few dozen supersonics, Mosquit style ones, that are going to overhaul that engagement wave. So, okay, now which ones do you engage? You've got additional problems of time. There's fewer of these, but they're going to arrive sooner. There's more of those, but they're going to arrive later, but there's a lot of them. We need time to deal with them all. And while you're all trying to handle that, then suddenly out of the sky comes your handful of hypersonics blistering in with maybe a 10 second engagement window. And it was also a distraction thing. If all your sensors are now, because as we know, most radar and everything, it scans the whole sky, then for fire control, it all locks into one position. So now if everybody's looking at this mixed cloud of sub and supersonic weapons coming in, and then on a slightly different vectoring comes the hypersonics, maybe somebody notices, maybe there's an advanced combat system with a partial AI on board that can redirect things, but it's still going to incite a delay in recognition and engagement of even if it's only a few seconds. When you talk about hypersonics, that could be the difference between it's on the horizon and there's a hole in my ship. So focusing on one thing or the other,
and the problem is if it takes out the air defense destroyer, which has that AI on it.
This is why to varying degrees different nations keep reserves. Why the Russians until relatively recently, and possibly even still now, I don't know, but up until at least the end of the Cold War, they still had large numbers of T-34s in reserve, and T-55s and T-64s and so on and so forth, because yes, they might not be frontline combat units anymore, but they're still tanks. And when all the high-end stuff is dead, if you have a tank and the enemy has a rifle, you win. It doesn't matter. You can have the world's latest and greatest SA-80 or M-16. If someone shows up in a T-34-85, they've still got the advantage over you. And I think it's slightly different, but with missiles, there is still a place for the small mass swarm subsonic weapon, even if it's at just as a distraction. Or as what's the Royal Navy doing with Spear 3? Going even below the level of the Exocet or the Harpoon, because that's not a particularly large weapon. And unlike the Exocet or Harpoon, let's say a single Spear 3 is very unlikely to sink anything much bigger than an OPV. It just doesn't have the mass. But it can do a lot of damage, especially to the upper works, radar, fire control, weapon systems, etc. So it can degrade your combat ability. And again, therefore, is a thing that you need to shoot down. And you can carry a disturbingly large number of those things on any kind of launch platform, even an F-35.
How vulnerable is a ship's radar system?
So you
and Spear 3 is going to probably have a very interesting targeting system, which is going to mean it's going to focus in on the areas which are vulnerable.
Yeah. So if you
go flammable,
and compared to the cost of a hypersonic weapon, Spear 3 is basically almost throwaway. Or equivalent. So, as you say, maybe you expend your stocks of silkworms because you've got them lying around from 20 years ago, but your newer, more advanced, almost effectively cluster missiles, those things you could throw literally hundreds, and if you've got a force of strategic bombers, possibly even thousands of them at someone, and there's physically no way to intercept them all, even if they are subsonic, because you don't have enough missiles, you don't have enough point defense. I mean, if, as I say, you look at the numbers that you can stack of those you can stack on an F-35, now imagine stacking them on a Badger H6? Clone. Yeah, an H6.
Yeah.
Multiply that up by a couple of dozen of them, and you could expend every single SM missile, RAM missile, and CRWS 20mm round in the entire fleet, and you'd still not be able to knock them all down. Granted, they're not going to necessarily sink your ships, but you now, you know,
the mission killer's good enough.
Yeah, you're out of ammo, and half your sensors are broken, and there's bits of debris lying all over the flight deck of your carriers. And then when the little glowy balls of the hypersonics arrive on the horizon, you have nothing left with which to defend yourself. And then you die.
So we're left with a problem, which we're starting to get back to a problem, which I can see was probably the argument used of the 6-inch versus the 8-inch cruiser. When the Royal Navy was going for all the 6-inch cruisers they could get and wanted all things, and the US Navy, when they were asked about it, said, well, in a nice way, our 8-inch cruiser will sink a 6-inch cruiser with a couple of hits before it manages to overwhelm us. That was their sort of idea. I'm never quite sure if it would work, considering how quickly they start building their own 6-inch spam cruiser. One would suggest that perhaps the US Navy were slightly less comfortable with that idea than they thought. But we come back to it is, we have to take out the launchers before they can fire. That becomes the thing. The only solution to that metric, the only solution which is viable, is you have to take out the launchers before they can fire, which comes back to your own Talons, your own cruise missiles, your own hypersonics, but also your own aircraft, if we're talking about the H-6. We're talking about the combat air patrol. We're talking about airborne early warning. We're talking about satellites and all those things. You have to start actually having the layers of defense rebuilt. And so, this is one of the problems.
Replace your F-35s.
Well, I would say it's the end of history problem, because the F-35 makes sense in a world where you're replacing the F-18 and the Harrier, and everyone's nice, and you're the undisputed champion of the world. But when you're the disputed champion of the world, you have F-14s and F-18s and intruders, because you want to have that extended range cap. That combat air patrol of those mean as anything.
Specialists.
Yes. And anyway, for the Royal Navy, I can understand why the F-35B makes sense, because let's be honest, it's a massive improvement on a Harrier. But for the US Navy, I've been getting lots of pictures sent through to me by people of various Super Tomcat ideas of what a new Super Tomcat would be. And can I just say, keep sending them. They're sexy as anything. They make my day. They really do look cool. But
okay. So in conclusion, what are your thoughts? Final thoughts on this sudden appearance of high power microwave weapons? Because Japan is initiating a project themselves as well to build these things. They recently canned the whole Aegis Ashore concept as a way of countering North Korea's ballistic missiles. And it looks like they're now going for 4 tactical high-powered operational. Can't see what the R stands for. Responder. Okay, pretty poor an acronym. But anyway, yes. Mm-hmm. Final thoughts. It needs more. Needs that flak. Might be enough for now.
I think on for both the offensive and defensive side of things, when it comes to hypersonics and microwaves, you have to take into account that any sane person, any sane nation, is going to approach this as a multi-layer combined arms approach. So having a single weapon system, either for the offense or for the defense, is asking for an awful lot of trouble, because one system you can find a counter for and won't be useful in all circumstances. So by all means,
your SM6 as one layer, this is your point defense.
It depends. I mean, this is the thing. In theory, yes, you would have your SM6 launchers. You'd have your microwave cannons. You'd have your flak weapons. You'd have at least 3 layers of point defense.
Deception weapons.
Yeah. In a perfect world. But let's face it, we all know that a lot of the time throughout history, and especially more recently, there's a great temptation by politicians and possibly some elements of certain navies to turn around and go, we have shiny new futuristic weapon, therefore this is all the weapon we need, therefore we can get rid of all the other weapons. It's happened before. It almost certainly will happen again.
Can you punch holes in the side of a ship on the other side of the horizon with a microwave weapon?
Well, I have I have this book by H.G. Wells. Anything is possible with enough energy. Yes.
Okay. So my
conclusion is going to be that I'm sorry, we need to go back to the Super Tomcat. Super Tomcat, Super Sea Fury, Super Corsair. I don't care what we call it, but we actually need to start thinking about outer area air defense because we need to extend that bubble. We keep talking about how close they're going to be, the hypersonics, etc. You know, how short the engagement range. Well, you have to extend the engagement time. And the only way you can extend engagement time is if you bring back, you have a longer range fighter. If you have AWACS, if you have that longer range fighter armed with an AGM 154 hypersonic version clone, I'm not sure what we'll call it, the Super Phoenix. I don't really care, but you need to extend that range. You need to extend that time of intercept because if you can take out the launch system, the launch vehicle, before it launches, you're golden. But also, if you can double, treble the engagement range at which you start whittling down the numbers of hypersonics, even if it only adds on, it increases engagement time to minutes, you are far happier. You are far safer. Anything that
rolls on the dice.
You need to, the whole point about hypersonics is you need to increase the engagement time, at least the viewing, the processing time as well, as much as you can. So you need to work on those sensors and you need to actually have weapons which can get out that far. And the only way you're going to do that is if you have, I like the F-35. There are not a lot of people with distractors on them, but I actually like the F-35 as a concept.
They really do match the US Navy's rust pattern at the moment.
They really do. But leaving that to one side, if you're a medium power, the F-35B makes a sensible one-stop shop. Yes. It's not going to be perfect at everything, but it's a sensible one-stop pot for medium power. The problem is for the US Navy is they're not a medium power. And they have been behaving like a medium power because they've gone for the F-18, which was the cheapest. Then they went for the Super Hornet, which is basically the F-18 being rebuilt and redesigned and called the Hornet. And now they've got the F-35 coming in. And honestly, what they need is the Tomcat. They need something to replace that role. The F-35 can do the F-18 role, the basic F-18. I'm not sure about the E-18G role. Frankly, the Super Growler is a very specialist beast. And honestly, I'm not sure the F-35. I know there are lots of people going to go respond to us to go, but they've got the tacky pod and they've got this ECM gear and all this stuff. And they've got all these things. Yes, they have. But the electronic warfare is a very, very complicated thing. And I think if you're tacking everything onto the poor pilot, you are possibly overloading them. And this is why I like the E-18G, because there is still that second person trying to do it and to be able to do it. So the pilot can concentrate on flying the plane and the observer, as they'd be called in the RN, is doing all the electronic warfare. And that makes sense to me because that's electronic warfare is not something which I currently feel is we can lead to an AI because we haven't got an AI that can do it. And is not something I want to leave to automated systems because then it all requires is someone doing something which an automated system isn't going to necessarily pick up on. So having that human gut instinct in there, it can be a problem, but the squishy organic bit can also be an advantage.
But, you know. All right, so squishy organic bits. Mm-hmm. HMAS Adelaide, 2 weeks later, still without full power, sitting off Tonga.
That's because the Australians don't have enough squishy organic bits.
I suspect you're right.
It's because they took a shoebox to sea. Shoeboxes are not well insulated.
Wrong brand.
I mean,
it's been more than a week since they've flown out support, apparently. HMAS Supply is heading off to quote-unquote support vessels in the vicinity of Tonga, providing relief. I'm wondering whether they're taking a tow line.
Probably a whole section of new parts, because probably they've got in there and found that they need to rebuild the entire engine on site.
So,
to be honest, yeah. It might just be a bunch of Amazon air conditioners that they can plug into the various PowerPoints.
Well, that was one of the first things they said, was the air conditioning still works, or at least the free refrigeration.
Which two different things. I mean, I'm just imagining all the crew now crowded up next to slabs of beef deep in the hold.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know. I mean, and then, you know, I'm quite determined. I'm quite convinced now that Australia is planning to fight the war. That's not the war after the next war, but the one that's after that. Because, you know, with the whole submarine debacle, 10 years after the submarine replacement program was supposed to have been initiated, we've cancelled it, and we've started an 18-month project to consider what might come next, hopefully nuclear power submarines. So we're only 8 months into that, but it's still not looking likely. So at the end of this 18-month review, we'll probably say, well, we can't get those. and they'll have the courage to say that, because it might be a different government by then. So we will then probably have to go back to, maybe this time we'll go back to Japan and ask them to modify their Soryus. So
Japanese will go, we'll build you a Soryus, but that's it.
Which we still won't get. Even then, we still won't get to the 2040s. And now, well, just no, to make things, no,
to be fair, to make the things Japanese could churn out some Soryus quite quickly if they wanted to.
And now, even worse, we've gone and botched the unbotchable Hunter-class frigates by coming up with this new concept called fit with but not for.
That's not a new concept. The Royal Navy's been doing that for about 60-odd years. That's not a new concept.
No, that's the other way around. We fit for but not with.
Yeah.
So this is the point, because the Australian version of the Hunter has to make up its mind whether it's going to be in air warfare mode or in speed mode, because it hasn't got enough power to do both.
Well, you see, this is just going to sound strange, but here is the point I make about the Australian and the Australian version. I do love it. You've got the Royal Navy design of the Type 26. It is generic, modular, and upgradable. It is very much, there are lots of components in there you can play around. And one of them includes the power level. You can get put more powerful power supplies in them, which would be sensible, because it is extra weight, but you're already cramming in extra weight and extra top weight. So actually sticking some extra weight in the hull might actually help.
Extra volume.
Yes. And basically, this is the point. The Australian, the Canadians have gone, we are going to build the expanded Type 26. The Royal Navy are sort of looking at going, well, we've got the conventional Type 26 for the first batch. We are probably going to continue that for the second batch, but there is a rumour of a third batch, and they might be broad. There's a phrase already going around, the broad-beamed sissy class, which basically means we're going to go Canadian level for a few of them. No, kind of like what we did with the Type 22s. Remember, we had the broad-beamed Type 22s. We had four of those come out. And that will be the interim until the Type 83s start coming online, basically is the idea.
So are you trying to tell me that the Australian Hunter isn't the expanded version?
No.
I think
you're not trying to tell me that.
I think
it's not the expanded version. That's the problem. That's the issue. You're trying.
So why is it an issue? Why is it? If that option is there, if that design is there, if, as you've said before on this podcast, that there were two versions of the Type 26 planned.
Yeah.
One was the standard hull. One was the extended hull.
Yeah.
Why is there this crisis?
Australia.
Oh,
because they went with the standard hull. The standard hull is the cheaper one, so we'll go with the standard hull. But then we're going to
pack all this expensive stuff in it.
We're going to expand. We're going to pack the equivalent of the expanded hull into the standard hull.
So it should really be Hatsuhara Mark II.
Yeah, it's just that. I love it. Whenever I look at the Hunter class, I look at the CSC and I see basically the Canadian Navy is trying to get what they've been getting ever since the tribal class destroyers. and their Next Generation and their Halifax, etc. They always want a good general purpose escort, which will do pretty much everything. And not to maybe the highest level, but will do everything to a quite a high level. That's fine. That's what the Canadians are after. The Australians are going, we want a first-rate anti-submarine warfare frigate, so we're going with the anti-submarine warfare rather than the general-purpose hull, which is what the Royal Navy are building. Fine, lovely. But we also want it to be able to do land attack and air
first
warfare.
First-rate anti-air.
A first-rate anti-air and first-rate land attack. And you can't do that on less than 14,000 tons. You can't, this is the problem that you're looking at is the Australians are sitting there going, well, we've got these wonderful air warfare destroyers, but we only built three. It's the end of history thing. It's Royal Navy's got two aircraft carriers.
We only had three.
Yes, I know you only had three, but
we only had three of Charles F. Adams's. We only had three Darings, or was it four Darings? But yes,
you had three.
The same ballpark.
Yes, but that's the trouble is you had three when the US Navy and the Royal Navy were a lot larger.
Now they're
a lot smaller. You need more than three. And this is what someone's probably realized and why the Hunters have been affected as they have been, because they've gone, hang on. Usually we have three, which gives us the capability and what makes us look good. But we can usually call on someone else to do it. But the trouble is we had three, the Royal Navy had nine and dozens of other ships. And we had three, and the US Navy had lots of these ships. And we have three, and the US Navy doesn't have, and the Royal Navy now only has six. So what are the odds the Royal Navy is going to send something to help you rather than its own task groups first?
Well, I think,
It'll send its thoughts and prayers, and they will respect you and love you, but there ain't much spare in the Royal Navy's cupboard to come out and help. They will come with their task group, but that's it. And it's the same with the US Navy. There ain't much in the cupboard that's spare to come and help.
The problem is, though, if you look at it, it fundamentally comes down to look at the type designation. It's the Type 26 is a Type 20X series vessel. It's an anti-submarine warfare vessel. Yeah. The Type 45 is a Type 40X series. It's an AAW vessel.
Hmm.
As you said, the Hunters are supposed to be doing AAW and ASW. Well, the Royal Navy has a designation for that. It's the Type 80X series.
Yeah.
Which has to be bigger. I mean, we've written a whole paper, which I do need to edit, about this. Look at the historic precedent. The Type 20X are usually a bit smaller than the Type 40X, and the Type 80X, when they exist, are usually 150 to 220% the mass of the Type 40X, and usually two to three times the mass of the Type 20X of the comparable time period. So, yeah, if you want a Hunter class to do the job, effectively the job of a Type 26 and a Type 45, then it's going to end up being a lot heavier and a lot larger. You can't make something do multiple roles without expanding it, and it's not expanding near enough. Yeah, well, the Constellation design is significantly heavier than its predecessor vessel.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when you look at the Constellations, they've repurposed them in some ways, but they're not expected to do the full role. And to be honest, the Constellations resemble much more of a general purpose. You know, they're supposed to do a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of the other. No one's expecting them to do any of those jobs absolutely fantastically, but it's the same thing with the Burkes, at least the later flights with their helicopters and stuff. They're supposed to do the ASW, but although they do have sonar, they've largely offloaded the ASW effort to their helicopters. Whereas the Type 26s, as more dedicated ASW vessels, have the full towed array set up, plus the helicopters, plus their own sonar, and all of that adds up to more room compared to a general purpose. So it's like, if the Australians want a Constellation equivalent general purpose vessel, I'm sure that can be done, but it's going to mean cutting out systems that make the Type 26 platform as good as it is at ASW. And if they retain them and try and do It's the speed, pressure, and fire power.
The same problem.
Why can't we get a constellation and add a towed array to it?
Because
space in the hole. There's only a limited. Also, there's the fact of the crew numbers. Have you looked at the crew numbers of the constellation versus the Type 26?
Maybe you could take a leaf out of the Age of Sail. You know, when they went into battle, they towed all their ship's boats behind them. So maybe the key is you have the towed array, but it's stored in the ship's lifeboats, and you just tow them behind you.
I think I prefer the first bit of that proposition, which is just go back to the Age of Sail.
Yeah.
Can I just?
It was such an easier proposition, and the firepower density was higher.
Can I just add something for the listeners? If they keep hearing me giggle, that's because I keep getting side eye from a duck behind Drak's head. Right. So he's got his professional office cover on normally, and every day when he moves his head back to one side or the other, there is the Draki duck, as I'm calling it, peeks out from behind from his headset, and I just get side eye from this duck, and I start giggling. So I am sorry if you hear me giggling at inappropriate moments. It's because I'm getting side eye from a plastic ducky.
It's called Duckinefell.
Yes,
Duckinefell. That's right. Yes,
yes.
Anyway, so speaking of Duckinefell, the Slavers are going into the Mediterranean.
No.
Yeah.
It'll be good for them.
The build up continues
after being chased off by the Irish fishing fleet.
Yes.
Well, they might still be being chased by the Irish fishing fleet. Let's be honest. I love the Irish, but they don't have a habit of forgetting grudges.
Fishing fleets 2, Russian Navy 0. Round 3 in the 2100s. I mean, it's this slow, gradual build up towards, you know, something happening in Ukraine. Whether it's going to be, what's going to happen or not is. Yeah, every. I mean, it's both slightly depressing and also absolutely hilarious how utterly disjointed the Western response has been. I think, to be honest, the main reason Putin hasn't invaded Ukraine is not because he doesn't think he can win. And I think he's trying to figure out, as much as anyone else, what on earth the West will do, because the West doesn't know what it's going to do. Germany doesn't want to antagonize Russia, so they're not refusing to send any kind of offensive military aid. France is written in the past day or so. Macron has been saying that there's a possibility of some kind of negotiated settlement. The US is basically doing the next best thing to we don't negotiate with terrorists, which is a blatant lie because they do a lot. the UK is desperately, desperately trying to distract from the Garden Party scandal by exporting our javelin stocks.
And in the defense of Boris Johnson, there is actually
very limited parapet to stand upon. Okay.
But there is actually something he has turned out to be quite good at, according to reports I've been hearing, because he is one of the few people one of the few politicians who actually speak Russian fluently. He actually apparently corrected the translator on one of the calls, because he was on one of the joint calls and they were trying to say what the point to be made by, I think it was, I'm not sure who it was, one of the other Western leaders, and that he heard the Russian translator, you know, converting it to Russian for Putin, and they hadn't converted it right, and he explained it because it was causing Putin to be angry, and basically Boris went, no, he translated it wrong. What they meant was this. So, you know, there are many things which you can defend at this point on the British government and all these things, but you can say that actually having a bit of a linguistic polyglot
It's a good way to deal with those oligarchs, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, frankly, we'll deal that one.
He's also given the amount of pressure he's under at home, he is very motivated to find something he's actually good at.
Yes.
getting back to the matters naval, which is what bilge pumps is about. We've done enough bilge. What the hell can ships do for Ukraine?
Well, I mean, we talked about in a previous episode the fact that the Russian amphibious ships, whether they're empty or full, pose a fairly serious strategic threat to the southern flank of Ukraine, which can affect how they're deploying their forces. And I mean, the Slavers,
If that was Ukraine right now, I'd be putting a lot of mines off my coast.
Yeah, but the thing is, the Slavers have I mean, they have two roles. One, that's extra defense for the amphibious ships, which makes the that formation look bigger and scarier, and therefore, you know, reinforces the idea of a flanking threat. So there's that strategic element to it. But also, let's not forget, the Russians do love packing cruise missiles on practically anything that floats. So it's an off-axis missile threat as well, because the Ukrainians only have so many surface-to-air missile systems of varying levels of performance. And let's face it, the vast majority of them are probably right now deployed on the eastern part of the bit of the country they still control, in case the Russians start throwing anything from cruise missiles to short-range ballistic missiles at them.
Or all packed around Kyiv.
Yeah, well, it depends how much they value their frontline troops. this is kind of the catch-22 Ukraine has. Put all your missile systems in the east and you can maybe protect your frontline troops enough for them to put up a bit of a fight. Pack them all around Kyiv and your capital is safe, but your frontline troops will just be erased by Iskanders, at which point it doesn't matter how many surface-to-air missile systems you have around Kyiv, because they don't work very well against T-80s.
Now, so the thing is, already in the Black Sea, there was already the Moskva, which is interesting.
Rolling its way to victory.
That is one of the... So the other one, the one that's joining them, is the Northern Fleet's unofficial flagship on occasion, the Ustinov. The Varag is in the Pacific Fleet, and when I say in terms of the Pacific Fleet, it's been... in overhaul for a while. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, the Ukrainia, which was the one that was still in Ukraine, which in 2019 they announced would be sold, but the ship remains as untouched as of 2021. Am I the only one who the Ukrainians were thinking, oh, we wish we'd finished that?
Probably not. Let's just face it. One would just be a nice target.
And they would have sold them all to China in the 1990s anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is the thing. The using ship for the Russians, using ships on the Black Sea offers a great strategic pivot that forces the Ukrainians to divide their military across two fronts, which they otherwise wouldn't have to do, which weakens their overall capability. Plus, obviously, they can interdict trade to a certain amount. I mean, it's not going to matter as much given how much of a land border Ukraine has if it does come down to do it. But, you know,
Russia has lusted after those ports for a long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Russia lusts over any port.
Well, any port that doesn't ice up 6 months out of every 12.
The nicest way, if I was Turkey, I'd be getting worried, because if they get through Ukraine, then they're just going to start lusting after Istanbul again.
Yeah, well, that's been a thing going back and forth between Turkey and its various ancestor states and Russia for centuries.
And it may also be why Turkey suddenly has done yet another about face and has decided to back Ukraine.
Well, it's the Erdogan roundabout. This week I will support puppies. Next week I will support concentration camps. And the week after that, I will support the moon rocket.
Basically, what happens is he spins a dial on the wall and goes, "This week we are supporting..." Click, 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 click.
No, don't like
that. Changing Facebook to the pink to the color pink.
Turkey, the one country where foreign policy is decided by a game of cards against humanity.
I'm constantly amazed that these ships can just go through that channel without any concern. But I guess that's international law, isn't it?
Well, it's brinksmanship, isn't it? You know, yes, you could stop them, but at what cost? You know, are you going to start shooting war with... And I think this is the thing that Russia has exploited. It's like, any of the individual things that Russia has done are, relatively speaking, trivial for the people who don't want them to do the thing to stop. But it means, A, that the people who are stopping them are the ones who are shooting first, and B, it means you're ending up in a shooting war with Russia. And there's a difference between, you know, an isolated individual action and war with Russia, but Russia has engineered it such that while there is a technical distinction, there is no practical distinction. which means that it can consistently strengthen its position right up until someone's willing to bite the bullet and go, this has a significant risk of escalation, but this is where we draw the line. It's
well and truly passed.
Yeah, and at which point Russia's like, okay, well, you have now crossed the line. Well, that's fantastic. Whilst you were, you know, thinking about crossing the line, we have built up all these wonderful forces.
But the problem I see for Russia is that also they're now sort of imbalancing themselves. And I think they are opening themselves to another form of naval diplomacy. Because if you suddenly have, let's say, Britain and America decide to launch a joint carrier exercise or a couple of carriers off the north coast of Norway, maybe in the Barents Sea, mm-hmm. possibly heading towards the White Sea if they really want to start winding up the Russians. Well, suddenly the Russians are going, well, yes, we've got submarines, but the only way submarines can stop those carrier groups moving around is to sink them. And that's the same thing back on the Russians. That's them, would then be being them offensive, them aggressive, and them being in the bad light. You can use this back on them. They haven't got the surface ships up there now. And suddenly, let's be honest, the Russians are, they're doing this in Ukraine because they're scared. Ultimately, I always point out the Russians are usually scared because they're always worried about, they're always seeing basically the nightmare, but nightmare around the corner before they even look around the corner in foreign policy terms. They are thinking they can control mass their forces and they can focus everything on Ukraine. If you look like even the hint at the idea that the war might widen, that any conflict might suddenly expand, that's going to start feeding into their own paranoia. And that's the thing. We don't want to move a load of ship troops into Ukraine because you can't support them. And frankly, deploying the 82nd Airborne to Poland, that's lovely. But in the nicest way, that's a light infantry battle group at the moment. Maybe we'll grow more, but even that is not something which they would just, the Russians would roll over compared to, I don't know, the Polish armored brigades, which would probably put up a fairly tough resistance. They might be located in the wrong places thanks to their basing being designed during the Cold War and being designed to defend them against things coming from the other direction, but they're moving. However, you can quite easily deploy and announce a naval exercise. You can quite easily, well, the Russians hosted one off the coast of Ireland. That's wonderful.
Until the Irish fishing fleet arrived.
Yeah, until the Irish fishing fleet decided, no, you're not going to. That was lovely because that was the Irish defending the British there because, you know, the British were going, we can't do anything because technically it's not our territory unless the Irish
ask us. Is this an argument to replace the Queen Elizabeth class with a whole bunch of trawlers?
No. I wouldn't mind having the trawlers as well as the Queen Elizabeth class, but I need both. But the thing is, ultimately, the way you can best cause the Russians trouble in making them back down is by playing their same tricks against them. And ultimately, if you do this North Sea exercise, if you keep the carriers up there and you have them exercising away, it's going to wear down your ships. And this is why you should have built 3 aircraft carriers. Or maybe build some LHDs which can do the carrier role in a pinch and they just guarantee availability of aircraft carriers. But either way, if we had had, we could still do it with the 2, we could still maintain a carrier group. And if the US Navy turned up with their carrier, maybe the French carrier came along, we could have 3 carriers sitting up in the North Atlantic going, hello, we're having a joint NATO exercise.
Wouldn't it be better to suddenly practice the defense of Gotland?
Oh, we could do that. That'd be quite fun. We could, of course, combine the North Sea carrier exercise, the White Sea, Barents Sea carrier exercise with a nice missile boat and exercise led by perhaps the Polish and the German navies in the Baltic.
Surely the Royal Navy would be true to form and send Prince of Wales to visit Scotland.
That would be quite tempting to do, but probably shouldn't be done unless we want to really wind up the Russians.
If you had a ship called Repulse, you might do that.
If we had a ship called Renown or Repulse, we might well do that. And if we had a ship called Renown or Repulse and we had a nice sort of Type 83 already built and it was battlecruiser size, like me and Thrak would like to see, we would probably send one to go and visit, I don't know, would it be Lithuania or Latvia first? Do you think they should go to Latvia to see if they can, you know, see Father Christmas? Should they have done that over Christmas period? It would have been quite nice. There are many options. Oh, maybe
just make sure you just make sure you pack enough lifeboats on them.
Honestly, again, the thing is that that's the case, but it's also a case of you're playing the Russians at the same game. They can, if they respond, they can stop you, but to do that, so they have to fire on you. And they don't want to do that because the Russians don't actually want to war with the West. Because at the moment, in peace, we're divided. In peace, then, if they actually started chucking missiles at anyone, they'd actually unify us. And the Russians are, and the Chinese are both quite smart when it comes to that one. They realize that they get more through being aggressive in peace and fighting peace powerfully than they do in terms of waging actual war.
Yeah.
Because in you can control peace.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, you've got a very large chunk of that 130,000 troops sitting in Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very far from there into what's it called, Kaliningrad,
or Poland.
Or Poland. If they want to, yeah. Anyway, just saying, you know, Belarus and Ukraine are a hell of a lot bigger than most people tend to realize.
Yes, they are.
At the end of the day, the longer this goes on, the more money it costs, and it's cheaper for Russia to keep to having moved troops internally. It's much, much cheaper for Russia to keep troops sitting around in a slightly different location within Russia than it is for the West to keep 15 different nationalities worth of troops in a country that doesn't speak any of their languages and is hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from where those troops are normally based. And with all the attendant logistics and maintenance tails, because, you know, apart from anything, you know, if the Russians need to maintain their armored fighting units, it's what, three types of tank and some variants on the BMP, and you've covered all the major armored fighting vehicles. Whereas if the West really wants to commit, you're going to be talking about maintaining probably a dozen different variants on ex-Soviet tanks, plus Leopards, plus Leclercs, plus Abrams, plus Challengers, and that's just the tanks. That's before, maybe even the Ariets, if the Italians want to get stuck in. And there's probably about six different versions of the Leopard 2 out there for the various countries have got. And that's before
and we the get versions into the Embravers.
Yeah, and that's before we get into the IFVs. So,
oh God, what's all?
But in a lot of ways, and it's the same thing with the ships as well. Because as long as the Russians have Crimea, they can have their ships in the Black Sea, and if they need to stop for maintenance, it's like, oh no, how tragic, we will go a dozen miles back into port for some refit and repair. Whereas long-term Western deployments to the Black Sea or into the Baltic or into the northern waters, again, longer maintenance and logistics tails. So,
to be fair, because thanks to Ross Life, etc., and technically we could always reactivate Scarpa Fleur if we really wanted to.
it's still hundreds of miles away compared to the Russians with their ports in the Crimea and St. Petersburg and whatever. So
we have to do a lot of spacing out of Norway, let's be honest.
Russia doesn't have as much money as the West, but in a long-term staring game, it's on Russia's own backyard. They can just sit there and stare and wait for everybody else to get bored and go home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I still like the idea of sending Prince of Wales into the Baltic.
That would be quite fun.
That's because you like the idea of any scenario where Prince of Wales ends up getting sunk again, because you like to you like to talk about Force Z.
I don't know. What can we call it? Force B? Yeah. But
I'm going to call it Force K, because that's usually quite successful.
Let's face it, you can't really get into the Black Sea. I mean, World War One taught us that.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe get into it with a sub or two, but even
that's the other thing, though. The other advantage I have to admit for anyone else is that once the Russians are all in the Black Sea, they can't really go anywhere from the Black Sea because it's quite easy to block them off in there. Even if Turkey doesn't agree, you just stick a submarine this side of the Dardanelles and go, come through.
But do they want
Should we send Queen Elizabeth down to the Dardanelles?
No.
That's been done before.
It has been done before, but you could say in the nicest way, the Italians and the French can deal with anything that tries to come out the Dardanelles.
Well, there's they a have sentence a lot, I never thought anyone would ever say.
Well, that didn't
work very well last time. It didn't work very well in the Adriatic either.
The Italians weren't involved when they're trying to get out.
The Italians, Adriatic. To be fair, I would trust the Italians. But then this comes back to the whole completely disjointed mess that is the current Western response. The fundamental problem is that if you put the Italians and the French guarding the Dardanelles, it's entirely possible, in fact, very likely, the Italians will probably hold up their end of the bargain. But it's also entirely possible that halfway through that little standoff, Macron will decide, actually, no, I have concluded a correct and proper way of dealing with all of this with the Russians. And, somewhat understandably, since he is, of course, French, he goes, France above all, we've worked it out. French Navy come home. And then the Italian detachment is left there going, we're not big enough to do this on our own.
Hey, Italians have SSKs. They can do it on their own.
Maybe. I still wouldn't want to be... I mean, you don't want to be the Italian fleet where you wake up the next morning and the Marine Nationale has just left. I think the single biggest problem with all of this is the fact that no single nation can decide how it's going to work with all the others. And a lot of the nations at the moment that are expressing very strong opinions contrary to each other, even though they're technically in alliance with each other, and in some cases like France and Germany, also within the EU, they do have a history of picking up their ball and going home, regardless of alliances and obligations, if they don't think their things are going their way.
Yeah, I mean, that's just fairly standard, isn't it, really? I mean,
well, yeah, but it's an advantage that Russia has because Russia is Russia, and anyone who disagrees within Russia gets to go to Gulag. or mysteriously falls over and, he fell down the stairs. Fell down six flights of stairs and shot himself three times in the back of the head with a Dragunov.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, I think we've probably done our dash for today.
We've got one more topic.
I think we can give it a skip.
We can probably talk about it next week.
Yeah, we can talk about gatekeeping in history at any time.
Yeah, let a few more people dig their metaphorical graves before we bring in the JCB and start piling the earth back in.
Ah, yes, they do. Well, thank you very much to listeners for listening. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We've had a good. It's been a fun time.
Catch you next week.
Yep.
Take care.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps. We're a bunch of naval geeks spout